Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the third hour of the program, boy, howdy, do we have two subjects to deal with. First of all, the sobering subject of suicide. There are a lot of myths surrounding suicide. Dr. Beverly Yonke will be our guest here for the first half hour of this last hour of Issues Etc. to talk about those myths and to debunk them. You can join us 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Then we will turn to a St. Louis Post-Dispatch editorial recently here, Origin of the Specious, fairly mocking a local school official for inviting someone from Answers in Genesis in to talk about intelligent design and to counteract the teaching of evolution. We'll get Dr. David Menton from Washington University in to respond to that op-ed piece in about a half hour here on Issues Etc. Looks like the American Idol tour. It really does. I mean, you look at the cities that these professors from Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, will be visiting over the summer. They're going to be in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Dr. Just will be there talking about Paul and his opponents in Galatia. In Kearney, Nebraska, a law and gospel sermon seminar there by Dr. Carl Fekencher. Who else will be there? Dr. Kurt Marquardt will be out and about. Also, Pastor John Pless, regular guest here on the program. He'll be in Salt Lake City, Utah. And then down there in Hickory, North Carolina, Dr. Charles Geeshan will be there. Dr. Walter Meyer III is also going out. Practically the entire faculty, one of my favorites, Dr. Larry Rast, he'll be talking about the formative influences in American Christianity in this series of, well, what they do is they take the classroom out to you. It's continuing education done the right way by the faculty of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, this summer. The dates are all over the place, so the best way to find out more about these really great opportunities for continuing education for pastors and for lay people, call Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Area code 260-452-2266 is the number. It's a special number. You can ask all about these continuing education courses. 260-452-2266. You can also find out more by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Just follow the links and you'll get to these continuing education opportunities put on by the faculty of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. Beverly Yonke joins us to talk about suicide. Now, we will talk a bit about suicide, but I also want to deal with these myths that surround suicide, those who commit suicide. Maybe even someone is entertaining one of these myths who considers suicide. Dr. Beverly Yonke is Executive Director of the Christian Counseling Service in Milwaukee. She's author of an article in the latest issue of Higher Things titled Myths About Suicide. Beverly, welcome back.
Happy to be with you.
What would you say in your experience is the biggest myth about suicide?
Fabulous question. You know, the truth of the matter is there are so many myths competing for attention that sometimes we simply imagine that anybody contemplating suicide is some sort of really squirrely head case and there aren't very many people who are at all influenced by the temptation to do something so horrific. And yet, the biggest myth is it doesn't really happen to many people. It's not really an issue about which Christians need to be terribly concerned. And then we look at something like the Center for Disease Control, and we discover that these people who are very much in the know really clearly confront that myth with authority, and they say, suicide is now a public health epidemic. And we as Christians say, oh, for heaven's sakes, how can that be? And the CDC says 50 to 80% of teens think about suicide when they're in some sort of jam or when they're in some sort of pain. And an unspeakable 8 to 10% of teens are actually going to attempt suicide, largely because they don't have other adequate coping skills. A lot of us tended to believe that suicide happened to other people, unchristian people, and that it's not really that prevalent. And yet the CDC says suicide is currently the 11th leading cause of death for all Americans, second leading cause of death for teens. And by the year 2010, suicide will be the number one cause of morbidity in the world. And so suddenly the myth that it's this whispered problem among other people is smacked squarely in the face, and we sit up and we say, I had no idea. And so the truth of the matter is, suicide is real. It threatens people. It threatens people we don't even know. Those we know as well. The person sitting next to us at the food court who appears to be perfectly content and happy, as well as the person sitting next to us in the church pew tending his or her family, may be actively suicidal, and we haven't a clue about it. It is a mysterious disease that can be deeply hidden from us, sometimes until it's too late to remedy.
Somebody says, look, if someone is really a Christian, they wouldn't even consider suicide. How would you respond?
I would say that unless somebody's come up with research to the contrary, Satan delights in tempting Christians, perhaps more than anyone else. He enjoys coming on to the field where people who are Christ's blood-bought children are put at risk. Christians, like anyone else, are going to be very, very prey to Satan and his work. Luther, in fact, tells us that Satan is the one we need to be most concerned about in terms of those who are prey to suicide. Christians certainly are influenced by Satan as well. Luther told us in 1532, he said, I don't share the opinion that suicides are certainly to be damned. And Luther goes on and says, my reason for this is they really do not wish to kill themselves, but they are overcome by the power of the devil. They are like a man who is murdered in the woods by a robber. So Christians, indeed, are as likely as anyone else to be tempted. And in moments of desperation and weakness and frailty and vulnerability, to succumb to the devil's whisperings.
Let's deal with some of the very common myths that are both held by people who never consider suicide and held by people who do consider suicide. Here's one. If someone talks about suicide, they're not going to do it.
I would consider people who talk about suicide to be a particularly high risk. We want for everyone to understand that ordinarily, suicide is not a topic for conversation. It doesn't come up at the dinner table very often. It doesn't come up around the water cooler. And when people begin to even think about harming themselves, let alone to make public statements about it, we need to be particularly attuned to the fact that they are, in some systematic way, focusing on this, thinking about it, concerned about it. And people who are healthy don't think, focus, or be concerned about suicide at all. Very often, it's the people who are talking about suicide who are desensitizing themselves to the horror of it, who begin saying things such as, you know, I could just croak off Friday. It's just things are bad. And they start by saying it in jest, and then they start by saying it in more sober fashions, and then they stop talking about it, and they do it. So people who are talking about suicide are very often in the early stages of accustoming themselves to the prospect that this is something they might consider as a pathway away from pain. There are, on the other hand, I guess we do need to mention, some people who are very histrionic, who are very dramatic, who are very theatrical. And you might think here of teenagers in the ages of about 11 to 16 who seem to go off and threaten suicide at the drop of a hat. Those are people who we tend to dismiss as well, saying, oh, she's just being so theatrical, and we need to be thankful she's still using words and not using pills. So language about self-harm must always be taken remarkably seriously.
I guess I'm thinking about this parent who says, golly, I heard my kid say that in an offhanded way, but I'm afraid if I bring it up, I'm only going to reinforce it or make them think, wow, they're really afraid about this, and then they'll be more serious about considering it.
Oh, absolutely. We certainly don't want to mention suicide to somebody who might be talking about it, a huge myth. We want to be able to confront and love anyone whom we believe is thinking about suicide, because one of the primary variables that might be a tipping point between restraint and taking one's life is a feeling of being isolated, a feeling of being solitary, a feeling of despairing that no one could understand. And most commonly, the perception no one cares. No one notices. And if someone takes the time to say, you know, I heard you are feeling really low. And in fact, I hear you're feeling so low, you're wondering if it might be better if you didn't even wake up tomorrow morning. Have you ever had thoughts like that? When we address people in a way that's non-accusing, when we invite them to be able to nod vertically to statements of pain, we are welcoming them into our world of safety and refuge and truth, of God's own wisdom and comfort, and we are rescuing them from their world of living in a cocoon without hope and in a desperate sort of isolation. And so when we talk with people about what they're thinking and feeling, they are no longer bearing the weight of whatever burden it is alone. The burden has been divided, and the likelihood of help and the likelihood of rescue is multiplied.
Well, someone might be of the opinion, Dr. Yonke, that if someone is seriously considering suicide, talking about it or not, then they've got a real mental problem. Maybe they'd say they're crazy. They might say that they're mentally ill or maybe even psychotic. Is that necessarily true?
We know for a fact there's a large correlation among people who take their lives and people who are clinically depressed. And we understand that depression is certainly going to, in some ways, influence clarity of perception, the ability to think objectively about things. And depression is regarded as a mental illness. However, there are many people who are depressed who function very effectively in daily life, who care for their families, attend their churches, receive Christ's gifts in the divine service every Sunday, and they're not people who are spinning about town doing drugs, holding up gas stations, or engaging in aberrant behavior. Sometimes the myth is that only people who are the real head cases and who do socially bizarre, unexpected things would be people who couldn't exercise control and couldn't get their lives together. It's simply wrong. Sometimes some of the most controlled, some of the most conscientious, some of the most dedicated people feel overwhelmed and feel they can't function, and they suicide. And not a person in their acquaintanceship circle would have for a moment ever considered them anything but responsible, appropriate, loving, and caring people. So yes, depression's a mental illness, but no, it does not mean they're bizarre and likely to be identified by their peers as unusual.
You mentioned before that Luther's opinion on some Christian suicides was these were people who were hounded by the devil into this. Then there are people who, whether the devil's involved, we don't know, but often it is a, at least it begins as kind of a selfish, self-centered notion. They think one of two thoughts, both of them kind of separate myths, but let's deal with them together if we could. Look, if I'll show them.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm gone, mm-hmm. they'll be sorry. Or when I'm gone, then they'll really realize how great it was to have me around. They'll appreciate me then.
Yeah.
Kind of flip sides of the same myth. Deal with them both, if you would.
Well, I think clearly people begin to have distortions of thought, either wanting attention from others that they believe has been missing, or wanting to punish others at a time they feel helpless. And the only thing happens for people who suicide is they don't get revenge, they get buried. People who suicide are rarely able to be made into folk heroes. Instead, we make little crosses and throw dirt on their coffin. And it's sometimes the extremes of thought and expectation that allow people to over-idealize what will happen when they suicide in terms of having others suffer or having others appreciate them. Ordinarily, all that happens is that another precious life has been lost and there's been no capacity for those gifts to be brought to full fruition and serve others. So it's a horrendous waste of something precious, and that's life.
We're talking with Dr. Beverly Yonke about suicide, the myths surrounding it. We will take your questions and comments on this subject for the next 10 minutes. Of course, if you want to call in anonymously, feel free to do so. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We also have an in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. okay, Dr. Yonke, you just raised it, so let's deal with it as a myth surrounding suicide. Look, I see no way out. Mm. My life, what I see ahead for me is not something I want to be part of. Mm. I don't want to live the life that I see ahead of me tomorrow. There's no point in living.
Yeah. And for people who are clinically depressed, who have suffered chronic losses, people who are what we would call at risk, those who may have prior suicide attempts or those who are isolated or living alone, those are the people who are more likely to succumb to hopelessness and to despair. And we as Christian men and women understand that hopelessness and despair is really saying life without God. If one has no hope, one is certainly saying, I am not able to take possession of the promises of God in Christ. Some Christians who say, I feel hopeless and I feel despairing, make a very keen distinction that I think is important for us. Some Christians will say, I know that in eternity I will receive everything that God has always intended for me through my baptism in Christ. But in this moment, in these days, in the bleak hours of 2006, the nature of my pain exceeds my capacity to have hope that it will ever end. There's no purpose in staying on planet Earth. I'm headed for the eternal feast. And so they say, even in the midst of trying to take their own lives, one client told me, nothing can separate me from the love of God which is in Christ Jesus. And that was his suicide note, which is chilling.
Let's go to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. This is DB calling from his car. Hi, DB.
Hey, I just want to thank you for doing this topic. I was actually in Christian ministry years ago, about 7 years ago, and I'd suffered with depression for years. And at one point, then I decided to take my own life. And during the process of that, I tried it on two separate occasions in the same day, and I chose not to do it. I'd like to say because I knew it was wrong, that I was thinking, that it was an unrighteous, sinful thing to do. But I just was so angry at the whole, my life and situation that I just decided that I was going to do this, no matter what God thought. But God did remind me during that time of my wife, who was just supportive and loving and caring, and the people that I was also ministering to. And I realized that I was going to leave such a path of destruction doing this to myself that I just couldn't do it. And so I got myself into counseling after that, and eventually had to leave the ministry and was in a hospital for a time. And, 7 years later, life is very different. I can see the good, and I deal with pain in, I think, a healthy way, and I get depressed like normal, like normally now. I go through brief times, but I deal with things very well. And God just brought me through all that, and I'm just glad that we have this subject, because it just seemed at the time when I was depressed that I just felt like I couldn't talk about it, because I was supposed to be this person who was ministering to other people, and I wasn't supposed to have problems. And you feel trapped, and you feel alone, and suicide seems rational and sane, and it's good to hear people talking about it in a Christian setting where we talk about grace and understand that God forgives all sin, and even this one. And so I want to thank you for talking about it.
DB, thank you very much, and very glad to hear your story there. He talked about that path of destruction that is left, that kind of turned him from the brink. And I've seen that as a parish pastor with suicides. I cannot describe what it does to a family, especially when it's a father or a husband. Dr. Yonke, your thoughts on DB's call?
DB's call is wonderful because it outlines for all of us the fact that absolutely anybody can be the victim of this kind of thought and temptation, but that we have a good and loving God who is prepared and equipped and desires to bring rescue and remedy if we will allow him into the moment, and if we will allow him to work healing, and if we will be able to deal with our own pride and to receive help, and to set aside our own impressions that nothing will change, nothing is good, nothing is possible, and to believe that, yes, God can work through counselors, God can work through pastors, God can work through caring others to assist us to examine what might happen if we choose to take our lives. And those same counselors and pastors and caring others can assemble a ladder of healing that allows us, in an ongoing basis, to continue to acquire the kind of skills and confidence and wisdom that DB has, so that he's in a very different place in these days.
We have only about 30 seconds here, Dr. Yonke. One of those myths is, look, it doesn't seem like God even cares, so why should I? 30 seconds.
In 30 seconds, what we have to do is we have to take our loving God at his word, and we have to believe that our God is incapable of lying to us, and we must believe his promise that he loves us so much that he would give us his own very own son. And if we have a God who is so willing to sacrifice his own son for us, he indeed will do all that is required to equip us one moment at a time, bring us to help and healing and confidence that we can continue to receive his gifts and look forward to his healing in accordance with his will.
You know, Dr. Yonke, what you just said there, I've never considered suicide. I don't know if I ever will, but I never have. But that describes my life. One moment at a time, trusting in the moment-by-moment mercies of God, those sure and certain promises that he makes. It describes my life.
There you go. And so as a result, we recognize that all of us, those of us who are struggling, those of us who aren't struggling quite as much, have an identical need upon our loving Heavenly Father to provide us with everything that is good, one moment at a time.
Dr. Beverly Yonke is Executive Director of Christian Counseling Services in Milwaukee. She's author of an article in the latest issue of Higher Things magazine titled Myths About Suicide. Dr. Yonke, it's always a pleasure. Keep up the good work. It's good to read this article from you, and it's a pleasure to have you as a guest.
Always a pleasure to be with you. Blessings with your work.
And you as well.
Thank you, good sir.
There is hope. Now, see, you might be saying, well, easy for you to say. Well, I'm not saying it. I'll be quite honest with you, folks. Depending on the day of the week, the circumstances, how much money's in the checking account, how the family's going, how things are going at work, there are as many ups and downs in my life as anybody else's. And I'm a pretty steady guy. When I say there is hope, and there's a light at the end of the tunnel that you can't see, I'm not saying that because I necessarily always believe that. Sometimes it seems to me there isn't one. And I cannot see a solution. Now, that is the time when you and when I rely not upon what we can see or what we think is going to happen next. We certainly do not take it into our own hands and decide that our life is ours to take, for whatever reason it may be. Now see, God looks ahead, and he sees what does come next, and he knows. He doesn't always tell us, but he has made this promise in Jesus Christ. For us sinners and hopeless, there is hope.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
The reformer Martin Luther and his theology have been understood and misunderstood for almost 500 years. Was Luther's theology merely warmed over Roman Catholicism? Was Luther a Protestant? How important were the ideas of sin, grace, and the justification of the sinner to Luther's thought, theology, and Reformation? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for May is called A Theology to Live By, The Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. The book is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. To find out more, go to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the Issues, Etc. book of the month for May, A Theology to Live By, right there at our homepage, issuesetc.org. Or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, and ask for A Theology to Live By.
Refuting compromise. Does all mean all?
Answers with Ken Ham, co-author of the book on why God allows death and suffering called Walking Through Shadows. Well, you've got me on this one, Ken. What is all this about?
Well, Mark, in Genesis chapter 7, the Bible records, concerning Noah's flood, that all of the high hills were covered with water. Now, Christians who believe in millions of years of earth history have a problem. if the fossil record was laid down millions of years before Adam, Christians can't have a global flood in the days of Noah. You see, such a flood would rip up this fossil record and redeposit it. It would have destroyed their supposed evidence for millions of years. Thus, they say Noah's flood was a local event. Now, those who believe in a local or regional flood have to say that all the high hills in Genesis chapter 7 doesn't mean all the hills, just some of them. And they say that the word all is used in the Bible in places where it doesn't mean everything. Now, that's true to a point. Any word can have different meanings depending on context, and all sometimes can mean most. But in Genesis chapter 7, it says all the high hills under all of heaven. So this double all makes it clear that the context means Noah's flood was global, not local. All in Genesis chapter 7 means, well, all.
Many more of your questions about Noah's Ark and Noah's flood are answered in a wonderful evangelistic booklet. You can obtain your free copy when you go to AnswersRadio.com. That's AnswersRadio.com.
Hi, this is Chuck Rathard. On behalf of the staff and volunteers of Share-a-thon 2006, we say thank you for your extraordinary generosity. If you miss Share-a-thon, I hope you'll respond to our Share-a-thon mailing, or by using the Give Now button on our website at KFUO.org. Or just call us here at AM 850 KFUO and we'll add your contribution to Share-a-thon 2006. Again, thank you for supporting the radio ministry of AM 850 KFUO.
A mother's love isn't dependent on what her child does or doesn't do, or on what worldly successes are attained. Mothers are committed to loving their children no matter what. And so is God. God's love is a committed love. You could say, if there was such a word, that God is omni-committed.
Hear Pastor Ken Klaus this week on The Lutheran Hour.
Sundays at 12:30 and 5 p.m.
The theatrical spectacle of Chinese opera and a grand parade and the traditional arts of folk dance, martial arts, tai chi, the theatrical forms of theater, costumes, the fairy tales of the culture and the food, all part of the Chinese Culture Days at the Missouri Botanical Garden, 4344 Shaw Boulevard in St. Louis. It's coming up Saturday, May 20th and Sunday, May 21st at 4344 Shaw Boulevard in St. Louis. Visit mobot.org for more.
Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., Mary Magdalene's Makeover. We'll talk with Christian apologist James Patrick Holding. What have they done with Mary Magdalene? She was just this somewhat modest disciple of Jesus Christ. Plays a significant role at key points in Jesus' ministry. But, wow, she's emerged looking very different from the one we find in the pages of the New Testament. We'll talk about it tomorrow on Issues, Etc. Did you read this Origin of the Species? Editorial in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch in the science section. Interesting. If you read this editorial, you might come away with the impression that creationists, I'm one of them, are just, well, maybe even worse than people who believe the world is flat and they're just about that smart and can do just about as much harm. Well, Dr. David Benton joins us here to respond as carefully as we can in this last half hour to this St. Louis Post-Dispatch editorial, Origin of the Species. Dr. David Menton is a regular guest, associate professor of emeritus of anatomy at Washington University in St. Louis, and a speaker for Answers in Genesis. Dr. Menton, welcome back.
Well, good to be here.
You taught for decades anatomy at Washington University. Did you find it necessary to teach evolution in order to cover your subject?
You know, Todd, I never taught evolution. Can you believe that? 34 years on the faculty of Washington University School of Medicine, editor of Stedman's Medical Dictionary in the histology section for five editions. I never taught evolution through all that time. Now, you would think that would bring the outrage of the students, wouldn't you? I mean, if the Post-Dispatch has even the remotest clue of what they're talking about, that should have brought a wild indignation from my students. And, you know, I can tell you in 34 years, I never had a student confront me and say that he felt that I was leaving something important out of their education. Evolution contributes absolutely nothing to our understanding of any area of empirical science. You know, during my 34 years, I think I probably taught on every single organ of the body, including pituitary, thymus, adrenals, you name it, prostate gland, everything. And I taught what is known about these organs, their structure, their physiology. And the students never found me short in my information. I was twice voted Professor of the Year for my efforts. And nobody ever said, but you know, you never covered the evolution, because evolution adds nothing to our knowledge.
Let's go through this editorial, Origin of the Species, beginning with what I mentioned at the open, and that is, it comes, I don't think it's even arguable here, and I think even the author, whoever they are, would probably admit that they come at the whole issue of people who are creationists, that is, who believe in a biblical account of creation, as though they are flat earthers. They're certainly unscientific, and they do not belong in the classroom talking about anything, not even something like intelligent design. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, they really even go beyond what you've mentioned. I think we call this nonlinear, when people just simply go off the page. The Post-Dispatch actually accuses Answers in Genesis and Mike Riddle, who spoke in the Potosi Public High School, as being not just simply flat earthers or not attuned to science, but they describe them as being anti-science. In other words, actually opposed to science itself. And, well, again, I can simply hold myself up as an example of a person who believes in the biblical account of creation. And I taught all those years, and nobody ever accused me of being anti-science. In fact, my students thought that I was about as good as anyone there in terms of being able to explain scientific matters in my field of expertise. But, you know, the Post-Dispatch uses just simple insult. It rises little above saying your mother wears overshoes. There's no substantive criticism. And, you know, Answers in Genesis, and certainly not myself, we are not anti-science people. We very much appreciate the contributions of science. You know, when God created everything and he created man, he told man that he would be able to subdue the earth or use the earth. And as you look at the book of Genesis, right away, man was involved in mining, was involved in music, made musical instruments, mined ores and used ores. Our ability to use the earth really depends on God's having made an earth that's understandable. Even Albert Einstein himself once said that the thing he didn't understand about the universe is that it's understandable. You know, that's a heavy thought. To you and I, maybe that the earth would be understandable is pretty obvious, but to the mind of Albert Einstein, it was not at all obvious that the universe would be understandable. And it is. And, you know, that's why I think science has flourished in cultures having a Judeo-Christian tradition, because unlike a lot of the, you know, the false religions in the world, nature is not capricious. It's made by a God who made a nature that, because it was designed, is understandable and can be used. And thus, Christians are not anti-science. Indeed, many of the greatest pioneers of almost every field of science we can imagine were Christians.
Let's go through line by line, if we could, on some points. One paragraph in particular sticks out from this St. Louis Post-Dispatch editorial, Origin of the Species. It's talking about Mr. Riddle, Mike Riddle, who's affiliated with Answers in Genesis. And it says, Mr. Riddle is a doubt peddler. The whole thrust of his work is to convince the unsophisticated that evolution is a theory in crisis collapsing under its own weight. What do you make of this?
Well, I think, you know, don't academicians often say doubt is good? Years ago, back during the 60s, you know, when the activists were all pumped up and the young people were into all sorts of things, questioning everything, there used to be a button that the in crowd wore, and that button read, question authority. And I've often thought it would be a good idea for people who teach general science in classrooms to wear that button and to act on that, to question authority. There's always room in science. I can tell you, based on a whole career of working in science, there's no greater mark of scholarship than to question authority in science. We simply don't take, you know, people's word in science as the last word and never question it. You always go back to the original hard data, and I'll tell you, whether we're a creationist or an evolutionist or whatever is beside the point. We have the same world. We have the same animals and plants. We have the same fossils. We don't have one set of fossils for creationists and one set of fossils for evolutionists. It's the same for all of us, and we need to question that. And a doubt inducer, I think, is a compliment to an educator. Far from an insult, it's a compliment. I hope my students in the 34 years that I taught at Washington University School of Medicine could say that Dr. Menton was a doubt inducer. He made us question whether what we were taught in science is really true or not. He made us go back and look at the data again. That's a huge compliment. Of course, the Post has no clue that they gave a compliment there.
Immediately following upon that line, I read this. Evolution is, in fact, the central organizing principle of modern biology. There is no scientific alternative to the evolutionary theory.
Well, you know, that kind of takes off from the words of the great, very famous evolutionist Theodosius Dobzhansky. And he said several years ago, he said something that's become known as Dobzhansky's dictum, and that is, nothing in biology makes sense without evolution. And that line has been used again and again in classrooms throughout America and in school districts and in arguments over creation and evolution in the public school, that nothing in biology makes sense without evolution. If you don't accept evolution, you can't make sense of anything in the whole realm of life science. I mean, that is so obviously and demonstrably untrue. I spent 34 years of my career, to bring up an old saw all over again, in which my students were, I think, noticeably impressed by my knowledge of life science. And enough so that they certainly gave me all the awards for my teaching, and many, many times a Distinguished Teacher Award, twice Professor of the Year. And they all knew I was a creationist and that I believed that there was a God who created everything. But you do not need the underlying theme of evolution to understand biology. What it is a paradigm. It's quite true that a majority of scientists believe in evolution. And they see evolution as being the philosophical underpinning of their view of nature. That is, they're completely convinced that there is no transcendental supernatural God who has created. Rather, nature must be explained in terms of itself. Matter, energy, time, and space is all we have. You have to explain everything. If people say gods exist, then they too have to be a part of matter, energy, time, and space. If they're not, they're not real. It was once said by a famous evolutionist that the whole of reality is evolution, a single process of self-transformation. And when you buy into that worldview, naturally you interpret everything in that concept. But you know, you can practice medicine and completely ignore evolution. In fact, all areas of empirical science can be pursued without any regard to evolution. I do not know of a single area that I had occasion to lecture on where my students would have been benefited by speculation on evolution. I can say how the eye focuses, for example, how the eye adjusts for different amounts of light. And we can get into the details, the physiology and the anatomy involved in focusing the eye and adjusting the eye for different amounts of light. But if I start now speculating on how this focusing mechanism evolved, it adds nothing to our understanding. And, you know, I just think we're wasting a huge amount of time in our public schools speculating on things for which there can never be any evidence one way or another. I would prefer that we just leave all this stuff aside and just stick to the real world of observable, repeatable, testable science.
We've got an email here from Bill in Los Angeles, and he writes this, and it goes back to a line from this editorial I read, that Mr. Riddle wants to give the impression that evolution is a theory in crisis collapsing under its own weight. Would you address that? He said he didn't respond to that part, that evolution was a theory in crisis.
Well, I don't happen to believe that evolution is a theory. You know, I have people all the time that tell me, and we're talking Christians now, who say, I don't have to believe in evolution, it's only a theory. And when I hear that, you know what I tell people? If evolution were a theory, you ought to seriously consider believing in it. But evolution is not a theory. You know, I think the average layman has the idea that the word theory is basically a synonym for pipe dream, something you've just concocted off the top of your head. A theory is a much more honorable concept than that. A theory really is based on, first of all, making some observation of nature, and then making some attempt to explain this observation, and then to be a theory, at first it's just a hypothesis. For example, I might hypothesize that the material at my writing desk that I'm sitting at right now is made of wood and is not some artificial material. That would be my hypothesis. Now, what I would do is design an experiment capable of disproving that hypothesis. I would say, well, look, if I take a piece of the material of my desk and I burn it, if it's wood, I should get some sort of an ash, whereas if it's plastic, I would get kind of a puddle. And so I burn it, and let's say I get an ash. Well, my hypothesis has survived this experiment, which was capable of disproving it. It still doesn't mean it's wood. It could be a kind of a compressed wood. It could be a paper material. And so I would have to go on to other experiments to test my hypothesis. And when my hypothesis had survived many such attempts to disprove it, it would then become a theory. And let's just look at evolution now. Life evolved from a methane ammonia atmosphere. Design an experiment capable of disproving that hypothesis. It can't be done. I mean, this is one thing that's wonderful about evolution. You never have to worry about anybody ever disproving your view, because it's all just scenario and speculation. There is no disproving. And so I completely reject the idea that evolution is a theory. Evolution is what we call a paradigm. A paradigm is sort of like a box. You're willing to believe everything that's inside the box, and anything that's outside the box is just simply unacceptable.
So in other words, it's kind of the evil twin of a theory, at least in practice, when no data or experiment is permitted to gainsay evolution. It kind of throws doubt upon its claim to be a theory.
That's right. You see, when people go into the biology classroom and they say, well, we want to present ideas that are critical of evolution, what they don't understand is this. To the evolutionist, the idea of the creationist is not simply wrong. When Mike Riddle spoke at Potosi, his ideas were not merely wrong. They were unthinkable. They simply cannot be tolerated within the realm of human thought. I don't think the average person really appreciates that. You know, you and I could argue over Fords versus Chevrolets, Todd. You know, I could say Chevys are better, you could say Fords are better. We wouldn't end up completely rejecting one another as being outside the realm of the thinkable. We just simply think I'm right, you're wrong, right? But in this issue, we're getting into the realm of the unthinkable. The idea that there would be a creator who could create by the power of his word that is outside of the observable, repeatable, elements of nature is unthinkable to the evolutionists, and I'm sure it's unthinkable to the editors of the Post-Dispatch. And this is why I don't think there's really a solution. I don't think we can look to the courts. I don't think we can look to the public schools to solve our problem. I must say, I'm just immensely impressed by the courage of Randy Davis. I hope he continues to be superintendent of schools in Potosi. But the enemies that he faces are so vitriolic, are so intense. One has only to read The Origin of the Species in the Post-Dispatch to see the nature of the contempt that is there to know that I don't think Randy is going to be superintendent very long.
Our call-in number, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're talking about the St. Louis Post-Dispatch editorial, The Origin of the Species, with Dr. David Menton. Let's go to the phones, talk with Joel in his car. Hi, Joel.
Hi there. I was curious if you would be willing to give us a layman's explanation or definition of microevolution and how that might play into this discussion.
All right. Thank you very much. It's a good point to bring up, Joel. Dr. Menton, make the distinction, if you would, between what is usually called macro and microevolution.
Excellent question, Joel. I'm glad you called it. Yeah, microevolution is something that, you know, does fall within the realm of the observable, the repeatable, and the testable. It is real science. I don't like the word or the term microevolution, because microevolution, almost the term, sounds like microevolution, that macroevolution is just micro written large. But it's not. I believe that what we call macroevolution, which is how we come to have, say, lions and giraffes and people, you know, from some very different kind of organism, we call that macroevolution. Microevolution, to define it, is really just the variation that we see among the individuals of a species. Let's consider, for example, dogs. The American Kennel Club, recognizes at least a few hundred variety of dogs, and my understanding is that more breeds are being added every year. And all of these few hundred varieties of dogs are all the same species, Canis familiaris. They are all capable, at least theoretically, of interbreeding. Now, a 3-pound Chihuahua and a couple hundred-pound Irish Elkhound, there are some problems here in interbreeding, just physical problems. But ultimately, these animals are capable of interbreeding and producing fertile offspring. And even if you add the wolf, Canis lupus, the coyote, Canis latrans, these animals, although they're different species, are capable of interbreeding with the dog, Canis familiaris. All of these are the same, what I would call, kind. The Bible uses the word kind, that God created kinds and that these animals reproduced after their kind. And you can get a tremendous variability, and this is built into the genes. An organism like a dog doesn't have a set of genes that's virtually duplicated in every other dog. There are little variations, and that allows us to have an Irish Elkhound and a bulldog and my favorite, an Australian Shepherd. Do I have an hour to talk about my Australian Shepherd?
Look, I know exactly what you're talking about, because I got a Border Collie at home, and I could talk Border Collies all day long, too.
And aren't they interesting? They not only anatomically look different than other dogs, but behaviorally. There's no dog that has the behavior of a Border Collie. The way it stalks the sheep, and it is a herding machine. And the Border Collie is just a dog. It's Canis familiaris. I know I'll have a hard time communicating a Border Collie owner that the Border Collie is just a dog. But
member of the family, Dr. Menton. Member of the family.
He is a dog. But, you know, these kinds of variations exist, and evolutionists have called this microevolution. Hey, if this is evolution, I believe in it. It's observable. It's repeatable. It's testable. But, you know, I've always wanted a bird dog. I tell people I really have always wanted a bird dog. And folks tell me, you know, Dave, if you've wanted a bird dog, why don't you just go out and buy a bird dog? And I say, you know, I don't think you understand. When I say bird dog, I mean a dog that can fly, that has wings. And, of course, you can't get that kind of bird dog, can you?
Can't breed one. Try as they might. Final question here, Dr. Menton, with only a minute. It seems a rather shrill response, this Origin of the Species editorial. It seems, as you said, condescending, insulting, personally insulting, in fact, to the two people it addresses, and generally insulting to people like me who do believe in creation and actually believe that there's a tremendous amount of value in human science. Why do you think the response is so shrill? What does it tell you about those who would object to, in this case, someone who advocates for intelligent design entering a classroom and addressing the issue in a school?
I think the hostility that we're seeing to alternative points of view is certainly unbecoming to the whole field of science. It's not what I've become accustomed to in my career in science. This hostility must be due to something that has absolutely nothing to do with empirical science. I mean, there people can discuss things, and although they disagree and get a little upset, it's not at all like this. I mean, the insulting nature of this whole article tells me that we have a difference of religious views here. The whole materialistic paradigm of the people, I suspect, in the Post-Dispatch is very different than the Bible-based paradigm of, say, Mike Riddle, who spoke in Potosi, and certainly different than my Bible-based paradigm, too. And as a result, they're getting very angry. I mean, the resistance of the evolutionists is becoming so outrageous that even secular reporters are telling me, what's going on here? I mean, the evolutionists are behaving in a way that just doesn't seem like somebody who favors the open arena of ideas. And I think this is going to become more and more obvious as you see the absolute hostility, the contempt of the editors of the Post-Dispatch, and sadly, many evolutionists. This is not science. We're talking religion fighting religion now. The religion of secular humanism responding violently to the religion of God who's revealed himself in the Holy Scriptures.
Dr. David Menton is Associate Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University in St. Louis. He's a speaker for Answers in Genesis. You can go to their website, answersingenesis.org. Dr. Menton, thanks for being our guest.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for May is called A Theology to Live By. It explores the theology and thought of Martin Luther in the way it was intended, not as some sort of ivory tower speculation, but of course as a theology that is to be lived. It's called A Theology to Live By, The Practical Luther for the Practicing Christian. It's $14.99 plus shipping and handling. Find the book and more information on it at our website, issuesetc.org. Or call Concordia Publishing House tomorrow and ask for A Theology to Live By, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. The book is called A Theology to Live By. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for May. Tomorrow on the program, Mary Magdalene's Makeover. Christian apologist James Patrick Holding will be our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.